Major Vizard, reel 9. I think we've come to the point now where you moved up to Bizerta for some landing training. Could you tell us about the move? And
The move was comparatively simple. We entrained and moved up by train from Maison Blanche, the closest railway station to us. And the journey was a good deal faster than those which I described earlier with the prisoners of war. The train actually moved along, so we arrived in Bizerta, I think, after about 3 days. We were all the elements which were going to take place in the invasion of Italy, although we didn't know it was Italy then, were located in scattered areas because there was a lot of enemy air activity going on. And the battalion's area was undulating hills. Olive trees were growing on those hills. And surrounding those hills, there were these lush fields of corn on the cob, growing to a height of 6-7 feet. And through those fields ran these roads with curious names given to them by the Americans, I think. Of boat route, hat route, and so on. We took up position there and began some fairly hard training. The officers and warrant officers were given an idea of their future target by being taken to a geographical formation, the silhouette of which resembled what we ultimately found when we got ashore, and we were told that this is such and such a place, A, B, C, D, E, and so on, and we were told then the outline of what we were expected to do. Nobody told us where it was. Everybody had guessed that it would be Italy, but no one gave any locations. So we, the warrant officers and officers of the brigade, 139 Brigade, were engaged for, I suppose, 2 weeks on this. 2 weeks of fairly intensive preparation for what the tasks which were to be set to us. In the meantime, the rifle companies carried on some pretty hard work. We'd never been as well equipped since we'd come abroad. We were really given everything that we could possibly have asked for.
Such as?
Clothing, boots, with a warning from the colonel that if we got boots wet, we should not get any further boots for 3 weeks after arrival, so to be careful not to get boots wet. And the weapons and armaments were which had been come depleted during the African fighting were all replaced, and we were well and truly. The quartermaster at this time, of course, was the same fellow, but Newman, and he did a great job with his RQMS, Larry Gaines. There was a certain amount of recreation. There were cinemas. There were some films put on because, of course, Tunisia was peaceful. But there was a lot of air activity, and by day, I recall, the big problem was moving around. If you were in a truck, then you always had to have an aircraft spotter standing behind the cab, and as soon as you saw an aircraft, and particularly a Stuka, bang on the top of the cab, of course, and they'd stop the truck and you'd leap into the ditch. Now, these roads, they were nothing more than dirt tracks through the corn on the cob fields, and clouds of dust, of course, used to come with all these vehicle movements, and this attracted the attention of aircraft. There were a lot of aircraft around because, as we later found out when we moved north, the whole of the area from Bizerta through La Goulette and Tunis, the Bay of Tunis, was not cluttered, but had considerable quantities of Allied shipping. French, mostly American, and some British shipping, Navy.
Now, did you? It says you had two exercises connected with the assault landing. Do you recall those? What they were exactly?
Yes, they were. As I say, we'd had this profile of hills, and we were told that in reality they would be a good deal higher than the hills were there, because this was really the Tunisian green jebels, but. The first exercise was a brigade was an exercise carried out by the brigade, but as the brigade was going to attack two companies in each battalion up, the exercise was actually carried out in phases. You had the first wave and then the second wave, and there was a lot of open country to be covered before you got to these hill formations. And these exercises were, they made sense to us, the warrant officers and officers, because we'd had this earlier instruction on what our ultimate target would be.
Did you have any actual work with landing craft and getting on and off landing craft?
But that was the second exercise, yes. The second exercise actually followed a talk from the American Admiral, who was Moran, Admiral Moran, and he gathered all these chaps together from the 46th Division, the leading companies of those, the officers and warrant officers, senior NCOs went to the cinema, and there must have been, I suppose, a big cinema it was, I think it must have been 800 fellows in that cinema, and he gave an address and he had some maps. They weren't very detailed maps, but we were destined for what was known as Green Beach, and he went through the possible what they intended to do, because it was not a straightforward question of sailing from Deserta to Salerno Bay. We were going to go through Sicily, and it became clear for the first time, actually, when the Admiral spoke to us. We hadn't realized that, but our superiors at division had laid it on, because they said, on a landing craft infantry wearing plimsolls, the feet get soft. So they wanted us to be on shore in Sicily for a few days, get the feet hardened. Anyway, the Admiral went on, and he told us of what the plan was for the naval side, the marine side, and after that, he wound up the speech. He was an amusing fellow. He wound up the speech by saying, well, gentlemen, that's about all. He said, there are too many of you to take questions, but he said, I'm not going to guarantee that my buddies will actually land you on Green Beach. But he said, sure as hell, I can guarantee that we will land you in the right country. And that I finished him off. And after that, small parties were taken to the harbour in Deserta. And we were introduced to these floating sardine cans. They were LSTs there for transport, landing ship transport, and then the LCIs. And they're rather like a factory ship with them, catcher ships and whaling. It reminded me of that because I'd done I'd been in contact with the Norwegians on whaling. It reminded me very much of the catching ships and the mother ships. And I inspected this and I saw the mess decks, very cramped, very, very tight, but with what we hope would be a short voyage, it shouldn't be too much problem. I was introduced to my skipper, who was a lieutenant, Melchett, Alan Melcher, and I am still godfather to his son, as he survived. He went through the Pacific afterwards, but he survived. And he took me what he called topsides, and we had to look over the ship, and then we went down. The crew was very limited in number. There was the skipper, there was his number one, who was a sub-lieutenant, there was a bosun, and there was a signals man, there was the galley. I think there are only three in there. And there was a Captain Stewart. It could have been more than 10, actually. 8, maybe. It was a very limited number of people. But then, of course, it's a very small craft. So we went over this thing. Tom Logan and I, Tom was my second in command, Tom Logan. And we went over it and looked at it. And the following day, I took the company's arm major and had a look at it, too. And he whistled when he saw the accommodation. It was very tight indeed. I don't think we actually embarked for about a week after that. And from our olive tree covered hills overlooking Deserta Harbour, we could watch the dogfights every night that went on. Because clearly the Luftwaffe did everything in their power to disrupt and upset. I don't know whether they thought it was a diversion and the real attack would come from somewhere else, but they weren't taking any chances. And it was, in fact, during one of those dogfights that General Horrocks was wounded because he was standing on the balcony of his hotel in Tunis, watching this dogfight going on up the coast, and he got badly wounded, and he was the army commander, so we had a new chap put in for about 4 or 5 days' notice, but it worked out fairly well. I was always sorry because I was a great admirer of Horrocks.
What did you like about him in particular?
Well, his method of he was a man who he was a soldier's soldier. He was a fellow who could combine his exalted rank with the understanding of the chap who had to do the job in the line or wherever it might be. And I've come across him before, and in the territorial days I met him a couple of times then. We went and trained near the brigade that he had. In the meantime, of course, he moved on. He was now Lieutenant General. But he's a very fine leader of men. You had confidence in him. Anyway, after this further 7 or 8 days, the order was given for embarkation. Now, A Company and C Company were the companies chosen. C Company was Pat remember his name. He fought all the way through Africa.
Joby.
Pat Joby. Not Pat Joby. George. George Joby. George Joby, the antiquarian, the fellow who became professor of archaeology at Newcastle University. George Joby, chain smoker, lugubrious, but a great chap, and got himself a DSO. Anyway, George with C Company and me with A Company, and I had Tom Logan and one fellow called Miles and another supervisor called Matthews. And the order was shirt sleeves and plimsolls. Now, we had changed from, I think we went on board in KD. Yes, we did, Cartierville. But, no, that can't be right. I think we changed from KD to Bavaris before boarding, because it was September and the weather in Italy for the next month or so was going to be wet and pretty hot. We went in Benares, that's right, yep. Yeah. And there were 120 in A Company, and three platoons, one, two, and three platoons, the first three platoons in the battalion, and the C Company, 7, 8, and 9. And our LCI was number 345, which was an easy number to remember. 345. And I went down and inspected these ramps that ran out of the beach training. It seemed a fairly simple job. They were just ridged metal, and they would they went to any angle according to the height of the water and the angle of the ship to the beach and so forth. And we embarked. There was a good deal of grumbling because everybody was in there. I mean, nobody was better off than anybody else. It was very democratic. The troops were cramped, the warrant officers were cramped, the NCOs were cramped, the officers were cramped. There was a tiny wardroom, and it accommodated the skipper and his number one, and myself and Tom, and that's all we could get in. Tiny, and we had a bunk. And this was what you might call topsides, the conning tower section of the LCR. We sailed on the night, on the, let's get this right, I can't even remember the date. I think it must have been, I don't know, is it in the book, was it the first?
They landed on the ninth, the ninth, yeah. The first, the 128 Brigade did, so.
Yeah, that's right. We landed on the ninth, right on their heels. But does it say what the date of the embarkation?
No.
No, I think it was, we were 7 days at sea, so I think it must have been about the 2nd of September. And we set off for, troops were very surprised when they heard that they were going to go land in Sicily. Nobody really got this through. The idea was feet hardening, because everybody had taken their boots off and put on their army issue plimsoll, padding around on board this vessel. There wasn't much padding you could do. It was so small that I remember we had to take fresh air by numbers. I mean, people would come aloft and be allowed to stay there 20 minutes and then they'd have to go back down again for an hour or two. It was very tight accommodation. Anyway, I think it was 4 days on the first trip. 3 days, maybe. Yes, probably 3 days to get to Sicily. And we went to a place which was called, as very many places are in Italy and in Sicily, Castellammare. And now, as we approached there, I said to the American commander, Lieutenant Melchett, I said, Mediterranean is supposed to be tideless. And he agreed. He said, yeah, that's right. Anyway, we ran in. But when we got in, we found, in fact, that it was not going to be so tideless, and the place that he'd selected for landing left us with, I suppose, about 5 or 6 yards of water to walk through. But now, this was the one thing that the colonel had said we were not to do. Anyway, so when I saw this, I said to the sergeant major, off boots, because we put boots on for the feet hardening. So everybody took their boots off, and we walked through the water, which was all right because it was sand. But on the beach, there were sharp pebbles, and there was not much I could do then about stopping people on boots. Everybody was surging up this beach. Sicily, of course, was in Allied hands. There was no enemy action except from the air. But we were making for some wooded area where we were going to find some tented arrangements. And of course, the blistering language from the troops when they marched up that beach. And I took a long time to live it down. In fact, I haven't lived it down yet. I still get it thrown at me at some reunions. People still say, yes, it's a bit like the beach at Castle Amari. Anyway, we eventually we got into an area where they've got boots around their bootlaces around their neck, could put the boots on and pour them. A lot of people's feet were actually bleeding. But I had the, I forgot to mention this, I had the padre with me, and I had the medical sergeant. And on Pat Casey's LCI, the number of which I'm afraid I don't remember, he had the medical officer and his half his RAP regimental aid post team. I had the other half. I had the medical sergeant, who was known as Nurse. I can't remember his name. No, his name's gone. But I had him and one of his corporals and about three or four stretcher bearers. And they were part of that group. And Pat Casey landed, I gather, some miles away, further down, to do the same thing. And we spent 4 days, I think, was it 4 days? Might have been about 4 days. With boots on, doing a fair amount of work with the boots on to harden the feet after the 3 days with the plimsolls. And then after we'd finished that, we were prepared for re-embarkation, and the sergeant major said to me, what about boots? So I said, boots on, you see. Whereupon we crossed the sharp, spiky shingle without any problem to get on this LCI. But to my amazement, when we arrived there, there was still a gap of water between the ramps and the beach. So again, the boots went into the water. There was nothing you could do about it. The troops surged through the water with their boots on and went back on board, changing into plimsolls when they got on shore. The Mediterranean is not tideless. It has a rise of several feet. Especially did around that coast in northwest Sicily. So we got back on board and we set sail. There was complete wireless silence for outgoing. And we set sail and we were moving from Sicily, we were moving up to northwest and we followed the coast of Campania. Now, incoming wireless messages, of course, were receivable. And it was during this, we'd been sailing about a day, and might be a little more, that we heard of the Italian proposed surrender at sea. And, I don't know, but there was a sort of, initially, there was an atmosphere of euphoria. Because, the eye ties are out. It's not that anybody had a very high opinion of the Italians, but nevertheless, it was better to have them out of it than in it still. And we had expected to find Italian troops facing our assault positions. So, of course, nothing would satisfy the padre, but he had a drumhead service on board, Thanksgiving. I took him aside and I said to him, now look, if you do this, you're going to put the wrong sort of emphasis into troops' minds. They think there's going to be the local mayor and the brass band ready to receive them, the Italians having returned. I said, the chances are that the Germans will have foreseen that the Italians were getting ready to jack it in and will have plenty of their own forces in reserve to take over. No, he said, no, it was a gift of God and so forth. And so we had to have a service. We had a short service. It was very difficult. The skipper was very worried because he said, if you put all those troops on the deck at one time, he said, you're upsetting the stability of the. Well, in the end, they had it. It was a very small one because we called the volunteers. And we were beginning to get seasickness. The journey over to Sicily, I suppose, maybe 20 chaps had suffered a bit. But taking off again from Sicily, we began to get increasing amounts of seasickness, which wasn't very pleasant for anybody. I didn't get it because I've never suffered from seasickness, but quite a lot of chaps were being seasick. And of course, not all of them attended the Drumhead service of the Partridge because they were in their bunks. Now, on the night of the 8th, the invasion armada, you could call it, not that we could see any of it, but incoming calls were coming thick and fast, and the wireless man on board the LCI was reporting the arrival of this and that vessel into the foreseen position. And I knew that the 128 were ahead of us and going in. And about 4 a.m, we could see flashes from on shore, and we could hear quite a lot of noise going on. The dawn came fairly quickly. It was September in the Mediterranean. It came about 6 a.m. There was a lot of gunfire going on, we could hear. There was also a good deal of enemy air action taking place, although the American Air Force and the RAF were there. And I also began with my binoculars, and I began to scan the vessels that were lying further offshore behind us, and I saw some very large ships indeed. And I asked the skipper, well, what are those fellows? And he said, well, in your Navy, you call them monitors, he said. They have 12-inch guns. He said, it's not a battleship, but he said, you call them monitors. I think in the American Navy, they're known as cruisers. Anyway, I could see these enormous red hulks flying on the skyline, flying up to the west. We went in. There was quite a lot of hostile fire from the shore. I could see splashes when we were still a quarter of a mile offshore. The skipper was very good. He was very competent. He had taken all his time to be 21, but he was very competent. And he knew where he was aiming for, and we had this profile of the hills, and I could see it quite clearly, and the training had been good. The profile was there, except that all the angles were much steeper, and they warned us about that. So I knew where we were going to, and I could see the town of Salerno on my left. And we were on pretty much on green beach, and as we got closer, I could make out Positano, not far down the coast. It's amazing how quickly seasickness can be cured. Because fellows who were lying in their bunks, as soon as they were warm and got themselves ready for the run up the beach, either seasickness went, demonstrating, I think, that seasickness is really in the mind, not in the stomach. Anyway, they ran up the ramps. There was quite a lot of, I found out later on, they had 88mm Tiger tanks hull down on the sand dunes. And they were banging away.
Had 128, what progress had they managed to make before?
About 1,000 yards inland. They'd had a lot of trouble, and a good deal of the trouble was still there because they'd overrun some of it. And these Tiger tanks were still banging away at us. And it was, the bits were flying off the LCI. I said to the skipper, we started to get off, and I said to him, well, don't hang around. I said, you better get yourself. Oh, he said, I'm stopping here till you're all ashore. And he did. And we all got ashore and ran like hell up the sand.
What was morale like as you went off?
Quite good. Seven fellows were killed there were seven casualties on the move up the beach. I don't remember anybody being killed on that.